Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for the Funville Nine, driven by AAA, the official weekly podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels. Here's your host, Trey Wilson.
Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Funville Nine, driven by AAA. My name's Trey Wilson. I'm the Director of Communications and the broadcaster for the Richmond Flying Squirrels. And here on this show each week, we take you behind the scenes with some of the faces and figures of the Flying Squirrels world. This week, I'm joined by former Flying Squirrels All-Star pitcher Tyler Sear, who is currently out in Sacramento, California, as a member of the San Francisco Giants 60-man player pool, working on trying to get his shot to make his Major League debut at some point for the San Francisco Giants during this 60-game shortened season. If you haven't listened to any of our previous episodes yet, they are all available on demand at thefanrichmond.com, as well as in most other places where you can find podcasts across the internet. We've had some great guests so far, and that continues this week with Tyler Sear. He's a two-time Eastern League All-Star, and right now he finds himself on the doorstep of reaching the majors, but that hasn't been without some hurdles along the way in his career. So with no further delay, Tyler Sear, thanks so much for taking some time to join us for this episode of the Funville Nine. How's everything going, man? How you been?
Well, Trey, appreciate it.
So you're in the Giants player pool. It's the taxi squad, kind of the reserve group of players staying ready in case the Giants need to add players to the major league roster. And since there's no minor league season this year, they have all y'all in Sacramento, the so-called alternate training site. What are the days like inside the world of the alternative training site out there in Sacramento?
Yeah, so it's obviously really competitive. Every day we're challenging each other versus pitchers versus hitters versus pitchers. You know, they got the machines out there getting the hitters going. No, so your average day is essentially kind of like a spring training day. We'll go in, we'll prepare for the day, do our routines, and then have, you know, play catch. And then that evening, there'll be essentially an inner squad. You know, we'll run 5-inning games, essentially, and then do it all over again.
So is it kind of like being in extended? I guess you didn't have a ton of experience with extended, maybe just a little bit last year, but it really is just like extended spring training, except with older guys, I guess, right?
Yeah, I would say it's an extended spring training with just a bunch of polished players and a few young guys that have the tools and more to be elite Major League players.
Now, you were with the Giants for the exhibition games, I guess the summer camp games, as they were called. The first one in Oakland back on July 20th, and then the next day at Oracle Park in San Francisco back on July 21st. What was it like being there for those games in a Major League stadium? Like, you're in this big, huge Major League ballpark, but there are no fans and it's completely empty.
Yeah, it was for sure different. You know, it kind of reminded me of the Fall League, actually. You know, when I was in the Fall League, there wasn't many fans, but the quality of baseball was still there, and your focus and your execution had to be really dialed in, you know. But I think it's all new for all of us, and it's definitely a weird feeling being in a massive empty ballpark. I think all of us are just blessed to be able to play.
Yeah, thankfully it's all temporary, of course. Now, did they run I don't remember, this is since it's been a few weeks ago now, did they run the fake crowd noise for those games?
Yeah. So we had both in Oakland and in San Francisco, they had like sound technicians kind of working the crowd noise, and it was kind of crazy. So the crowd noise was kind of aligning with how the game was going, right? Mm-hmm. Louder crowd noise for our hit, no crowd noise for theirs, right? And then the roles flipped when we were in Oakland. Louder crowd noises for their hits, none for ours, right? So it's a little bit trolling going on, but it's a fun trolling. And thankfully, you know, this is all going to be, you know, temporary. So
that's got to be so weird just thinking about it. You know, I've been in some stadiums that have been empty. You know, working in the minor leagues, occasionally you go to some ballparks that are very big and completely empty on like a cold Tuesday night in April where maybe there's been a rain delay or something like that. But just being surrounded, you know, like especially in Oakland, because it's such a massive structure out there, and just being surrounded by all these empty seats, but you're still hearing this noise of a pretend crowd. The whole concept of that just seems like it'd be so weird. But I guess when you're out there and you lock in, if you're just focusing on what's going on the field, then it doesn't really feel all that much different.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the game's still the same. You still have a job to do and your focus still has to be there. But it definitely is different. That's for sure.
Well, let's chat a little bit about your journey to the present day. So for those who don't know, Tyler Sears from Fremont, California, which is out in the Bay Area near San Francisco and Oakland, kind of. What was your life like growing up there in the Bay Area?
You know, life was pretty busy. I played three sports growing up. I played football, basketball, and baseball all throughout my entire life until I was a senior in high school. But, you know, growing up was pretty cool. We had a lot of fun activities to do. Before Tesla, no one really knew what Fremont was. Now that Tesla is essentially one of their main and first manufacturing plants was in Fremont, now everyone essentially kind of knows Fremont for that. But growing up, it was awesome. You know, we had great weather. We were in the Bay Area, close to the ocean. A lot of good sports out here, you know, when it comes to everything. And I think that just has to do with how big the Bay Area is and the amount of players, you know, that we could pull from. It was just it was a great place to grow up. I, you know, wouldn't change it for anything.
So you said you played football and basketball as well. What positions did you play in those sports?
So football, I was a strong safety pretty much my whole career. And then
I can see that.
My junior year, I got approached. I played football from 8 years old until I was like 17. So it took up a lot of my life and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I learned a lot of things, but junior year of high school, made the switch to quarterback, got approached by our coaching staff and they were like, hey, you know, we want you to be quarterback. And I was such a defensive minded guy that I didn't want to do that. But because, you know, the team and the players wanted me to be the quarterback and blah, 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 that I kind of just rode with it. And then, I would say after that, I was tired of getting beat up. So I hung up my football cleats after my junior year and being quarterback.
Now, I read somewhere that you didn't start really focusing on pitching until your senior year of high school from the baseball side. Is that right?
Yeah. So that is correct. You know, I was, I love hitting the long ball, love hitting home runs, love, you know, making a diving catch in the field and love throwing the guys out, you know, whether it's that throwing them out at first or throwing them out at a base from the outfield. That's kind of what I love. But when I started getting, you know, playing at elite travel ball, I realized that, wow, I'm probably not going to survive being a hitter. You know, we're facing Joe Ross every year for high school playoffs and he's sitting 92-95 and with a wipeout slider, and I'm going up there seeing 9 pitches on the day and that's a wrap, you know. So I got approached by coaches that I trusted and they said, hey, you know, you should probably learn a little bit more about pitching and let's try to kind of hone into it. And so that's probably when it started. Was I would say December of 2010, I was playing basketball in high school, and then that's when I got told about pitching. And so I kind of just had that mentality of, hey, you're gonna start pitching more. And that's when I started to focus on it. And it was crazy.
So at what point did you start throwing 99 miles per hour? Because obviously that was a process to get to that point where you were up near 100 with your fastball, right?
Yeah. So that's kind of a crazy story. So going into my first year of junior college, I was still kind of learning how to utilize my body down the mound, still trying to repeat a delivery. You know, I might have thrown maybe, if I was lucky, 88 miles an hour, 90 freshman year of college. And then my sophomore year, I chose to redshirt at Ohlone College, which is in my home city of Fremont, kind of just to be around my sister. And she was young at the time. She's a young baby, and I just wanted to watch her grow. Like, watching her grow was just took up all my time and energy. I was so amused by my little sister, you know, like she was so embedded in me. And every time I seen her, her eyes would light up. So I was like, you know what? I just want a red shirt, spend time with her, still go to school, you know, do things. But what happened was I started to lift weights and started to eat a bunch more food. And next thing you know, I hop on the scale and, you know, at home we had a thing where you would measure your height, and I measure my height 6 months later and I'm 3 inches taller or whatever. And hop on the scale and I'm 25 pounds heavier. And so then all of a sudden, you know, I started throwing these bullpens and the catchers were like, yeah, wow, this is coming out firm, you know? So when I was redshirting, they would pull up the radar gun on my bullpens and it was like 92 to 95, right? Kept climbing, kept working that, you know, when I was redshirting, the coach would reach out to me and say, hey, do you want to throw, you know, on a Tuesday to our guys? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I would throw to their starting lineup, our junior college's starting lineup, you know, every Tuesday. And it was fun. A lot of trash talking was going on at that time. I was sitting, you know, 92 to 96, and that's pretty decent for junior college. And then, you know, just kept getting better and better. And then, you know, rumors started coming out and played some travel ball, you know, continued to lift and train and, you know, got into the California Heat and travel ball with fans in the stands and getting excited. And I would say that summer is when I started to throw really hard. I was probably sitting like 95 and 98. And at that point, you know, Trey, I had a bunch of offers, obviously, you know, when these college coaches see velocity, they get excited. So, you know, I started getting a bunch of offers and all this stuff. But when I went to the counselor, I was like taking the minimum classes due to redshirting. So I had to go back to junior college in order for me to go to my dream D1 school. And I just thought at the time going back to junior college wasn't going to challenge me and I wasn't going to learn. I was just kind of going to be stagnant in my growth. So I decided to, you know, go to Embry-Riddle after doing research there, obviously, and learning the winning tradition they had and all this stuff. It was an easy decision for me to go there. So yeah, Stray, I would probably say started to kind of figure it out my sophomore year when I redshirted. That summer for travel ball, I really started to throw the ball hard. And then kind of fine-tuning things at Embry-Riddle, just continued to be more consistent and create some off-speed pitches that have became a threat. So yeah, that was the journey of the velo. It didn't happen overnight. A lot of eating and a lot of weightlifting. I'd probably say a lot of carrying my little sister. So I have to give her a little shout out too.
Yeah, credit her for the big fastball. So with you getting such a late start on pitching, and or at least pitching kind of full time, did you have many looks at all coming out of high school?
No, I actually had more. The only scholarships I had were for football.
Who was looking at you for football?
So D2 out of Missouri, that school, also East Carolina University.
Yeah.
The Pirates, is that right?
Yeah, ECU, East Carolina.
ECU, yeah. ECU was one of them. And then a few local junior colleges that wanted me, but like I said, it was nothing crazy. It was more so like, hey, come check out the campus, take your official visit, and we'll talk numbers when you get here, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't nothing with any substance. It was just kind of I call it fan mail. You know, they see, oh, this guy has some talent, stamp his address, send it out, right?
So yeah, that's
kind of what it was. It wasn't anything of substance. It was just a bunch of fan mail. You know, for me, I at that time I already suffered a pretty significant injury. I broke my hand and had 5 screws put in my left hand when I was a sophomore playing football. So I just kind of weighed the pros and cons, and I just thought that, you know, longevity baseball would be it. So here I am.
At AAA, we've seen breakdowns, lockouts, and full stops. 118 years of them. So trust us when we say we can get through anything by navigating it together. See how we're helping to keep you safe. Visit AAA.com/keepmoving.
So you went the junior college route, and then after that, you headed out east to Daytona Beach to go to Embry-Riddle, as you said a moment ago. And on the surface, that seems like a pretty out there place to go. It's a really highly regarded aeronautical school. At the time, they were an NAIA baseball program, and life in the NAIA is the life that I know pretty well. But they were a powerhouse baseball program at that level. How did you end up down in Daytona? You said some coaches were recruiting you and looking at you, and you mentioned it a little bit before, but kind of expand on that. What led you down to Embry-Riddle? Because that's a pretty out there college choice.
So, I mean, pretty much like when it came to that post summer ball summer that I had my sophomore year, pretty much I could have chosen what D1 I wanted to go to, you know, but that's the thing. I would have had to go back to college and stuff. And when it came to what are my other options, the NAIA route was a thing. And for me, it was a choice of, okay, well, you could go to Lewis and Clark, right? And you're going to go
to another
World
powerhouse
Series every year.
Yeah.
And, you know, da, da, da. But then me being a Cali boy, I was just like, wow, snow? I was like, oof, I don't know if I could do that, you know? I wear shorts and a t-shirt and some sneakers for the most part, you know, back then. So the snow was pretty deterrent for me. And then once I started doing some research on, you know, the other powerhouse NAIA's, this school, Embry Riddle kept popping up. And then it was like the next thing after that was like the education. And then the next thing after that was, you know, their pitching coach and like his philosophy, right? And so like, wow, okay, well, this is kind of aligning for me. You know, they win a bunch of games. Pitching coach, from what I've been hearing, is thorough as they come. You know, the skipper and the head coach is nails, you know, and he runs a tight shift and he demands a lot of his players and, you know, they win. And there's a reason why they win is because of the tools that, you know, they give you is pretty much structure, right? You create a structure for the players around us. You create that bond and everyone has to buy in. So when I found out like what that on my own doing research, what the university was about, did research on the head coach, where he's been, did research on the assistant coach, the pitching coach, did research on guys that weren't there and what they had to say about it. I would probably say it was the easiest recruiting gig ever for Randy Stiegel, because I already did my research before I talked to him on the phone, and he didn't know that. But I was already committed before we talked on the phone. So when he talked on the phone, I kind of acted like I didn't have my mind made up, you know, just to see where they kind of stood. And the reports that they were getting, I guess, were pretty good at the time. And so my decision was pretty easy. And at the end of the phone call, I said, okay, well, yeah, I'll commit. Send the packet over, and when do I fly out? And he was like, what'd you say? You know, so it was, and he makes jokes about it all the time. Who's your easiest commit? Probably Tyler Sear. What? So yeah, that's kind of how it went down. You know, I was more so looking to be challenged and feel uncomfortable and kind of get away from, the norm that I was used to in California, right? I wanted to learn, and I wanted to dedicate myself to strictly baseball and education. So that was the main focus on, you know, Embry-Riddle. As much as they found me, I found them, and it was just a blessing. You know, couldn't script it up any other way.
That's one of the things that's so different about baseball and trying to make it in baseball, right, is they'll find you. If you're good, the major league scouts will find you. You can pretty much go anywhere. It helps to go to a good program in the NAI level like Embry-Riddle, but I mean, we see NAIA guys pop up in the big leagues. Brandon Beachy, who was one of your teammates last year, played. He was actually not even really a full-time pitcher in college. He was a third baseman at an NAIA school back in the day and went on to have some good major league success before some injuries kind of took hold of his career. You know, I went to an NAIA school, and we've supplied a few players, several players into professional baseball in recent years. And I've had some guys that have made the big leagues out of a small NAIA school in southwestern Virginia. Basically, if you've got the talent, it's not like in football or basketball or some of the other bigger sports where you kind of get shuffled down if you're in D2 or NAI or D3 or something like that. It's a really tough road to make it. But because baseball casts such a wide net and you have 40 rounds of a draft in a normal year and you have all these levels of minor league baseball, if you've got the talent, somebody's going to find you.
Exactly, yeah. If you look at the years probably before I was at Embry-Riddle, I mean, you look at the records, Trey, it's unbelievable. It's like 62 and 7 wins and, you know, all this incredible stuff. My junior year was the first year that we lost double-digit losses in like 6 years, I think it was. And so that was kind of a slap in the face. I mean, we had our Friday starter is a big leaguer, like Daniel Ponce de Leon. So, I mean, there was no easy arms coming out of our staff that you were going to see. It was high caliber arms. And even if they didn't have, you know, the big league stuff on paper, the big fastball, the big breaking ball, I mean, these guys would dice you up. They would learn the tools that they have, and they would harness those, and they would pitch, and they would absolutely dice you up. So, you know, when it came to that, like you said, if you're good, they will find you, right? And for me, it was really a blessing to have, like, guys like Daniel Ponce de Leon there my sophomore year, because scouts were coming for him. You know, scouts would be there for him, obviously. I mean, if you would see him pitch at that level, you would understand why, and even today. So, you know, Daniel would go in and he would go 8 2/3 or whatever, right? I mean, there was no, every time he got the ball, it was 8 innings essentially. So, you know, I would go in there for the last inning and the scouts would stick around and they'd be, oh, who's this guy? And, you know, I'd pop up some good numbers on the radar gun and, you know, that kind of kept him coming along. And then it's funny you say that, because on the weekdays, Trey, we would play D2 schools. We would play all the D2 schools in our conference. I'd say in our conference, that are in the conference now because they are D2. At the time, we were NAIA. So we would play these D2 schools on like a Tuesday. And guess who would start? I would roll out of bed and I would start against these guys, right? And they're like, oh, cool. Yeah, we're playing this NAIA team. We're going to we're going to beat up on them, da, da, da. And all of a sudden, there's more scouts in the stands than they've ever seen, right? And back then, you know, in college, it's kind of intimidating. But for me, I could care less. You know, for me, I was never supposed to be there anyways. So for them to be there was just a plus. And so for me, I used it as motivation to show them, like, why they came out, to make sure that the gas money they spent to get there was worth it. So, you know, I would face these D2 schools, and I would be sitting, you know, 94 to 97 and getting upper nines late in the game, right? And it was really fun, you know, competing against those guys, because for one, that stigma for the NAIA, you know, they're like, oh, these guys are NAIA, we're gonna creep up on them. And there was no easy games on the weekdays when it came to facing the D2 schools. So, you know, stuff like that kind of helped the process, obviously, right? Being in such a great weather state like Florida, and with the baseball history that they do have in spring training, it's easy to get guys out there to watch, right? You know, stuff like that kind of helped the process when it came to being seen. But at the end of the day, you know, to those who are listening, if you're out there and you continue to do your work and you continue to produce, it doesn't matter where you're at. You could be on a JUCO, you know, field in the middle of nowhere, or you could be at an NAIA, you know, or you could be at a top tier D1. If you're good, you're good. And if you do your job, you're going to get found. So don't get deterred on where you go and the path that you take, because everyone's different.
Yeah. I mean, there are guys who make it to the big leagues from the NAIA, and there are guys playing for like Vanderbilt who don't get drafted. You know, I've always thought that the NAIA, you talk about the stigma with the NAIA, and I always thought that the competition level there was pretty similar to D2 at the top, right? The top of NAIA and the top of D2 was pretty similar in the competition level, the talent level. It was just that NAIA didn't really have as much depth. D2 was a little bit deeper, but some of those NAIA programs, the two that you've mentioned here, like Lewis and Clark and Embry-Riddle, I mean, there's a ton of baseball talent there, and that's never an easy walkover win for D2, D1, whatever it is that they're playing against. But so when you went down to Embry-Riddle, what was your major? Because like a lot of guys in college, they major in something like exercise sports science, which I don't even know if that's something that like exists at Embry-Riddle. So what'd you major in while you were there?
I'm going to go on a wild guess and say that does not exist at Embry-Riddle. There was no basket weaving classes at Embry-Riddle either. Every single class was like super, you know, demanding, no matter what it was. It's a private university, so their professors like have, you know, a lot of pride in their work, and they demand a lot of their students. At the same time, they're willing to help, and they're going to give you all the tools to be successful. But my major was Homeland Security with minors in counterterrorism and aerospace engineering. I'm going to switch the second major, which is aerospace engineering, to cybersecurity. But yeah, so that was my major. So it was pretty interesting learning about a bunch of things that create terror here in the United States, regardless if that's a, you know, a lone wolf, a terrorist organization, natural disasters, you know, fall under that category, natural disasters that are then weaponized. So it's just a bunch of interesting things that we learned there. But yeah, that was my major.
So Homeland Security and counterterrorism. So like, if you weren't playing ball, what would you be doing if you had gone down that career path, like working in the CIA or something?
So I'm not really, I wouldn't really get into the government branches, so-called, just because, you know, I want to be able to kind of branch out. But I mean, you know, I could do the CIA. The thing with when you do stuff like that is your family takes sacrifices, right? So like, in order to have a family that you're around all the time, having a job like that, and for what I would want to do, it'd be pretty unrealistic. So if I would do something like that, I would probably have to be like super single, no kids, don't want any kids. And then I'll just be embedded in that work, right? But for me, I would probably, you know, try to work for a private contractor, kind of like Lockheed Martin, you know, preferably, or like a private security firm, you know, and that line of work is, it can be dangerous. So it's a discussion that you have to have with like your loved ones before you do, you know, jump into that line of work. And there's also some of that work that's, you know, done at a desk, cybersecurity and, you know, intel reports, right? So it kind of just all varies. But for me, you know, I would like to, I'd probably see myself working for, for Lockheed Martin or a company along those lines.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, thankfully right now you don't even have to think about that because you've got this this good baseball career working. And that came out of Embry-Riddle. You got drafted by the San Francisco Giants. And I didn't ask this when we were talking about growing up in San Francisco and Oakland area, but did you grow up a Giants fan?
I grew up both, to be honest, A's and Giants. Like, I'd probably have a I had a Nick Swisher jersey on with like a San Francisco Giants hat. Growing up, my pony league team was the A's, but I also loved seeing Barry Bonds hit dingers in the water. So it was a two-edged sword. I loved seeing Tim Lenz to come pitch. So for me, I just love baseball. And the A's and the Giants were right in my backyard, and I was lucky enough to watch both of them growing up. So, you know, I would probably say as a kid, I was both. And obviously now, you know, what side I'm on now, but you know, as a kid, it didn't matter. It was just baseball. Okay, basketball. Okay, football. And that was kind of like the cycle from like probably 5 years old until my senior year of high school.
That's gotta be pretty cool growing up in an area that has not one, but two major league teams close by. Like, I grew up in southeastern Virginia, about an hour and a half, 2 hours east of Richmond. And our closest team when I was growing up was the Orioles. The Nationals didn't exist yet. Mm-hmm. They were still in Montreal. And, before I went to college, I probably only saw like three major league baseball games in person. I think that has to be cool growing up where you have like, you kind of have your pick. You've got your National League team and your American League team right there up the street.
Yeah, for sure. Not to rub it in your face, Trey, but there's been multiple times where I've seen two MLB games in person the same day.
I've gotten to do that now some as an adult, but for us it was like, that's why minor league baseball is so important. And you've gone through and you've seen it over the years, and you've come up and played in some of these communities. But bringing professional baseball to these communities mm-hmm. that are so far removed from major league baseball, you know, I grew up going across the river from Portsmouth into Norfolk to go to Tides games. We'd occasionally come up to the Diamond to watch the Richmond Braves. That was our access to professional baseball. I mean, you weren't too far away from San Jose, I guess. I don't know if you ever went to any games there in a ballpark you eventually ended up playing.
Oh, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it's part of the importance of minor league baseball and what that means to people. So for you, growing up a fan in the Bay Area, both teams, of Oakland and San Francisco, and then you get drafted by the Giants, what was your draft day like? Was it kind of a surprise that the Giants took you?
Yeah, so my draft day, we just got done. We went to the NAIA College World Series right before that, and we placed third. We kind of got home cooked by the home team, Lewis and Clark, checked the tape. If you have any questions, anyone can get their paws on that. Check the tape.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it at all.
Yeah. So anyways, so we just got done, playing there. So we were on our high horses, but we were kind of down, right? Because, I mean, we had all the tools to win that World Series, but we were back in Daytona with myself, my buddy Stetson Nelson, and Jake Cavender hanging out at the house. Just got done having a beautiful day at the beach. We probably crushed about 2 bushels of oysters. For those who don't know, that's probably about 120 oysters. And then we had some big old steaks on the beach. And then, so we just got done having a good day, you know, go back to the house, turn on the draft. You know, this is the second day of the draft. So I'm listening, and all of a sudden, you know, I keep getting texts from my agent, like, hey, so-and-so's up next. They're going to snag you. So-and-so's up next. They're going to snag you. And it just didn't really happen. And then all of a sudden, listening to the thing, and the San Francisco Giants have selected Tyler Sear. And I was actually doing dishes at the time. And my roommate heard it. And he was like, you hear that? And I was like, no. Because it was on my little tablet I had. We didn't have it on TV. And he's like, man, you just got drafted by the Giants. I was like, no way. And so obviously we were all pretty stoked. But it was just a casual day. And then after that, I think we went fishing. We walked down to the pond that we had near our house at the time. And just went fishing. Got some phone calls from this family, said thank you, but didn't really know what it entailed at the time. You know, you don't really get a full grasp of it until you put on the uniform, and right. So for me, that was kind of my draft day. It was pretty casual, but I was glad to be able to spend it with two of my buddies, which is awesome.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty low pressure type of way. Like, you kind of got it on in the background, you're going about your business and, you know, crushing some oysters and steaks. It's a pretty good way to not be overly focused on it. But for you, was it something that was kind of cool for you getting drafted by the Giants, since you grew up in that area, going to games at what's now Oracle Park and watching that team on TV, knowing that, you know, you got a shot to be in that organization?
Yeah, I mean, it was unbelievable. Like, I mean, if you would walk in my room as a kid, you would see posters of like pretty much all these guys that I've had a chance to share a locker room with and, you know, throw live batting practice to and pitch in inter squad games too. And so it was really surreal, for sure. You know, just kind of getting the wrapping your head around it. Like, oh, wow. Okay. You know, if I do my job at a high level, you know, I should be with these guys, you know, hopefully sooner than later, but it was just crazy experience. And like I said, it didn't really hit me until I suited up and I shared a locker room with those guys a couple years later. That's mm-hmm. when it really hit me, like, wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here you go. Like, you know, this is not just a hobby anymore. Like, hey, this is legit. Like, this is a job and you're right there, you know? So that was a pretty surreal moment. So I think it hit me really hard 2 years after being drafted, finally realizing, right? Cause you don't really see many of these players that, you know, were my idols. I didn't really see many of them my first year. They were kind of like that folktale, like, oh, hey, so-and-so. We're like, yeah, but where is so-and-so? You know, you hear about him, but you never see him. And so, yeah, it was a awesome moment. And still to this day, it's super refreshing.
More of our conversation with former Flying Squirrels pitcher Tyler Sear coming up in just a moment. Life constantly throws us curveballs, and this year has been full of them. With so many people working from home or driving less, Elephant Insurance believes your rates should reflect that. That's why they've lowered their auto rates to help their drivers save. It's just one more way they've managed to stay flexible while staying true to what matters most, our community. See how Elephant can help you save by starting your quote process today at elephant.com. Elephant, insurance on your terms. Back here on the Funville 9, driven by AAA, my name's Trey Wilson, and this week I'm chatting with former Flying Squirrels pitcher and current San Francisco Giants 60-man player pool pitcher Tyler Sear. Once you got into pro ball, the Giants started moving you up pretty quickly early on. You know, you made a brief stop in the Arizona League after signing. Pretty sure you struck out the side in your pro debut, if I remember reading that right. And then you finished out that first season in 2015 with Augusta, skipped over Salem Kaiser to go to Augusta. And then your first full pro season, you had about half a year in low A and then got bumped up to high with San Jose to finish the year. So what was your introduction into pro baseball like across those first couple of years?
Yeah, so at first, you know, it was really well. I had to make some adjustments with like just overthrowing and the baseballs were kind of a big adjustment for me with my pitches. Like everything I was throwing was like taking off and it just wasn't really like they weren't competitive pitches. You know, I was so used to throwing like pitches up there and guys swinging at it because it looked like a good pitch. Right. But when you started facing professional hitters, you have to make adjustments. So, you know, I did that and I adjusted quickly. But I would say for the first, you know, couple, I'd probably say for that first year, it didn't really, you know, faze me much. I was my pitching coach, Dave Thurneau, prepared me so well during my junior year. He wasn't preparing me to pitch in the regionals of the NAIA or the World Series in the NAIA. You know, looking back now, it's easy to say that he was preparing me to pitch in big leagues. Like the conversations we were having were getting more in depth and we had some ideas and some methods to the madness, judging the swings. So for me, I used all those tools I had and I just kind of ran with it. And, you know, the ball bounced my way a few times, but, you know, for the most part, I was making really good pitches and, you know, everything was flowing. So, you know, it was pretty seamless for my first, you know, full year there, missing a lot of barrels. And, you know, I kind of just grew from there.
In the second half of 2016, you got to pitch for San Jose, which is really close to where you grew up. So you were basically pitching at home, right? What was that like?
Yeah, it was unreal. I mean, there was like a conversation I remember I had to have with the GM because the ticket situation, I was like, look, I have like 25 plus people coming every home game. Like, how are we going to work this out? And he was just like, hey, I know you're from Fremont. Don't worry about it. Just write it down and we'll make it happen. And so that was cool. But, you know, and pitching in San Jose was unbelievable. The crowd was always into it. You know, I have at least like 20 people there a game. And so it was unbelievable just being able to pitch at a stadium that I seen, you know, Pablo play at, Posey, Bum, all these guys that came up through there that I had a chance to watch. And now I was, you know, pitching there and it was unbelievable. Just being the hometown kid, you know, having success with it was just all you can ask.
Well, after you finished up the year 2016, pitching with San Jose, offseason, come back in 2017, you get to Double A for the first time. You're moving up the ladder kind of right at that normal pace and trajectory. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But even well before you came to Richmond, even before you were drafted by the Giants, you had some time playing ball in Virginia. You played for the Waynesboro Generals, the Valley League, in 2014, which is just a couple hours west of Richmond, a college summer league team. What was that experience like pitching out there in Waynesboro?
Waynesboro is awesome. You know, they were kind of hounding me all summer to get out there, and selfishly I wanted to be in California and see my family, you know, and spend some time with my sister. And but finally I did get out there, and it was all that and more. You know, the city of Waynesboro really embraces that team, and God, we were eating so good. Like, every you think of summer ball, like food, right? What is the first thing that comes to your mind? It's normally like pizza, hot dogs, and hamburgers.
Yeah,
right,
fast food. Yeah.
But like for us, it was not that. I mean, we were getting chicken, steak, mashed potatoes, just any, imagine mom cooking a big old party food, right? Like that's what it was. It was all the moms in the community coming together, putting together their best dish. And, you know, after every game, we were eating like superstars. And on top of that, we were winning at a high level. And we were a cool group. We all bonded together. But Waynesboro always has a special place in my heart. Just having that tight knit community was something that I've never had in my life. Because growing up in the Bay Area, for those who don't know, it's God. There's like every single inch of land is pretty much a house or a condo where I grew up. And so I lived in a court, but like the camaraderie in our court was really tight. But I couldn't tell you the neighbors on the court next to us, right? Or I couldn't tell you the neighbors on the court next to them. But when you go to Waynesboro, I lived at a host family, and my host family knew every single person on their block. They could drive down another mile, and they would know those people. So just that tight-knit community, like, was so refreshing, you know, to be a part of. And honestly, like, what college kid doesn't like mama style food after uniforms are so fresh? It was unbelievable. You know, just a great community.
Yeah, you got a little preview intro there that summer of some Virginia hospitality, that's for sure. Waynesboro.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
Waynesboro was always, when I was in college, Waynesboro was my halfway stop. So there was always like my pee break stop on the way back to school. Mm-hmm. So it was like 3 hours from home, 3 hours from campus. That's most of my Waynesboro experience, is usually just traveling along 64, like grabbing something to eat or taking a bathroom break. But y'all won the Valley League Championship that year, right?
Yeah, we did. Legendary comeback for the boys. You can't script it up. We were down a bunch of runs late, and prototypical like rally, base hit, broken bat, bloop hit, line drive that tipped off the glove of the infielder, and then base clearing, right? So little things like that. We ended up winning. I'm not kidding you when I say the whole city partied. It was everybody. Like there was probably close to 5,000, 6,000 fans at that game. And for those who don't know, that's at like it's not an elementary school, the field, but it's a nice field. And you can only imagine they have you have your dugouts, obviously, that are flat, but then around it, it's just pretty much a hill. So everyone's sitting on the hill, right? And it was packed. Like, oh gosh, you can't even imagine. You couldn't see a spot of grass on the hills anywhere for how many people were there. And got a ring out of it, and just a great experience in Waynesboro. You could probably help me with this. What's the gas station in Virginia where they make sandwiches and stuff?
Sheets. Well, the one in Waynesboro is probably Sheets. In Richmond, we have Sheets.
There you go.
Yeah, Sheets. We have Sheets.
Yeah,
at Wawa.
So Sheets. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I would
when
always
I first,
stop.
Yeah.
When I would go through Waynesboro, that's where I would always stop for my, when I was on my way to school. That was always my my bathroom break spot. My bathroom
go.
Break and a quick snack spot.
Yeah. So I might have eaten my body weight in Sheets sandwiches. Buffalo wrap with extra everything. I touched down, you know, they picked me up from the airport and they're like, you hungry? And I was like, yes, I'm hungry, starving. So we go to Sheets and I'm like, we're going to a gas station to get food? I'm super confused, right? And they're like, yeah, trust me, you got to get a sandwich. I was like, get a sandwich from a gas station? Are you kidding me? Like, that's a sin back home, you know? Like, you don't do that. Yeah. You go to the deli or you go to the sandwich spot. And I'm not kidding, Trey. I ordered this sandwich and it was the most amazing sandwich I've ever had in my life. And I might have just eaten that for, you know, the time I was there every single day. If I could, I'd sneak over to Sheets and get me one of those sandwiches. But yeah, I thought that was a cool memory I would share with you. Because I know if you're from Virginia, you know about the Sheets sandwiches. And if you're not, then you need to know.
Dude, you think it's known in Virginia? So I spent 4 years with the Altoona Curve, which of course you know. And Altoona is the headquarters and hometown of Sheets. And
oh, there you go.
Boom. They have one on like every corner. I think it's like 80 Sheets in a 50-mile radius or something like that. And there's one right across from the ballpark there in Altoona. So I probably ate more Sheets food while I lived there than anything else. And now we're in Richmond. There's a Wawa right next to the ballpark, which is similar but different, of course, you know, but it's another place. You go to the gas station, you're getting a sandwich, and it's a foreign concept to a lot of people when they come into town, but yeah, that's really funny that's one of your standout pieces of memory from your time in Waynesboro is the Sheets that they have out there off I-64.
It's good stuff. You know, I try to stay away from it now, but I don't regret eating it for probably 12 days straight back then.
I mean, summer ball diet, right? Now they got you on like a nutrition program probably and all these things that they have to have everybody get their max performance. You can't really be going out eating fast food every day.
Yeah. You gotta fuel the body nowadays, right?
Yeah. You gotta be a little bit more cautious about what you're putting in, what you're intaking. So let's fast forward. Let's get back on the timeline track. Let's go back to 2017. You got to AA for the first time in your career, and of course, you came to Richmond. And what do you remember about coming to Richmond for the first time?
So like obviously, my first thoughts were like Waynesboro. Like, oh, cool. Going to a city like Waynesboro, right? Not anything close to it. Richmond, Virginia is a beautiful place. You know, when I was there, our team was a little bit older. It was my first taste of AA. So I was kind of that young guy that was like, you know, getting the fun hazing and also like learning, right? Staying quiet and kind of just learning. But, you know, my experience was good. You know, I had my AA growing pains to start the year, you know, kind of getting just, you know, learning how to pitch to professional pitchers that hit the ball really hard on a consistent basis. And then, you know, just kind of trickling into a closing role, out of nowhere with kind of a surreal thing too. And just being able to kind of, you know, control the controllable. Like we didn't really win much, that year, but just always come in and staying positive. And that makes it so much easier to do when you have a great staff. I know you weren't there my first year, but nothing's changed. Like, you know, through and through, first class people from, you know, the security guy, Leon at the back to, you know, Parney all the way up top to Parney, right? Through and through good people, you know, so that made it kind of like a home for me at that time. And then I made it a home for myself going back there 3 years in a row. So, yeah, the initial thing, it was just awesome trail. Like that city's beautiful. You want to talk about some good food. Richmond, Virginia has it. That's for dang sure. So, you know, just kind of embedding myself in the city. I lived in the museum district my first year. And so that was awesome being close and just being able to explore, you know, before going to the field. I have a great love for that city and for the people who make the Richmond Flying Squirrels, you know, run.
Yeah, man, I know exactly what you mean. It's part of what drew me to coming down here, aside from just being close to home for me, only a couple hours away, but just the great people that make this organization happen and just how awesome of a city Richmond is. So you talked about moving into closing some. You became a closer in 2017, and your performance in that role, you got named an all-star, you finished second in the league in saves, even on a team that didn't win a whole lot of games, so there weren't really a whole lot of save opportunities there. And then you were almost untouchable down the stretch in August of that year. It seems like things were really going well for you on the mound at that point.
Yeah, you know, I was throwing the ball really well. Yeah, you know, there's a point where, I mean, I would just get the ball and it was straight dominating. And every pitcher has those spurts, right, where you get it and you just feel unhittable. And on top of it, you're making your pitches, locating, and you know the stuff is there. So it was really fun just to have that and to compete and give the team the best shot to stay in every single game. Was something that I kind of took pride in. When I had the ball, didn't matter the score, I wanted to get three quick outs so that my guys could go in the dugout and they could get bats in their hands and they could go to work. So it was just fun. You know, it was a fun year. I think I had almost the same timetable last year, end of August-ish when I went on a heater. about a month and a half.
I don't know. Anyway, it seemed like your whole 2019 season was kind of on a heater, except for maybe like a couple of small speed bumps.
I've been pretty fortunate. That's for sure.
Well, 2017, after that season, you go to the Fall League, and then going into 2018, you got that non-roster invite to Major League Spring Training. Giants send you back to Richmond to start 2018, and of course, we talked about it a little bit, but I was with Altoona at the time. I got to see two of your last three outings back in 2018 before your season kind of came to a screeching halt, and then you hit the DL in the beginning of May, a sore elbow, and eventually ended up having surgery to repair a fracture in your pitching elbow. So, like, what happened there? What point could you tell that there was a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I started to feel discomfort in camp in 18, but you know, you're getting all these chances, and you know, even the fan in left field is telling you that, hey, you're going to be in the big leagues this year. For me, it wasn't like saying I was hurt wasn't an option, you know. But going into that camp, if you look, you could see that my stuff was like not the same, and so I completely understand as to why they sent me back to Double A. You know, my stuff just wasn't the same. I was in a lot of pain, but I was just, you know, kind of living in the moment. And then, you know, get told I'm going to 2A, which I completely understood because, like I said, my stuff was, you know, average at best.
Well, like I remember seeing you those last couple outings, and I had seen you in 2017 look really good. Like I remember, like that's a guy that I remember seeing, right? And then those last couple of outings, I think it was two out of your last three outings, and you know, looking and being like, well, this guy, something's different here. Something's kind of off.
Yeah. I was just in a lot of pain. Tried to deny it for probably a month and a half, 2 months, but it came to a point where I was just not helping the team out. You know, I was doing more damage to the team every time I got the ball than I was doing good. So at that point, it was time to like man up and be honest about what I was going through. And I think my body did that for me. Once I kind of realized that, all right, you know, this is it, then the pain really started to hit. And yeah, so we just had a chance to kind of get fixed up. And yeah, so we kind of pushed the surgery back a little bit so I could get in really good shape. And then was just really excited to get fixed up and to get back to the me I knew that I was, you know.
What was the injury in your elbow? What was that fracture, and do you know how that happened?
Not many people know this, but when I got drafted, they took an image of my elbow, Trey, and they seen the fracture. And so, you know, they were pressing me, hey, you feel any pain? I was like, no, I don't feel any pain. Hence why I signed kind of later, because they were kind of like delaying it. Also, I chose to go to California and see my family for a couple of weeks before getting right back into it. So after that x-ray was taken, we had a conversation, casual one. Hey, you feeling good? Yeah, I'm feeling great. Okay, cool. So what happened was I signed, and then they sent me out there to play however long, you know, a couple of days after I started pitching. And I mean, I was 95 to 98, you know, in my AZL debut. I think I shook out the side or whatever, and then the next day I get called up to low A. It wasn't a thing of, hey, can you pitch? Of course I can pitch. At the time, I didn't know what throwing pain-free was. So I was always used to throwing with a little bit of discomfort, but it was nothing natural, right? So like if you have a paper cut on your finger, like that paper cut's going to hurt for the first 3 days, right? But after, you know, the fourth day, your sensory neuron system is going to kind of dull that pain out. Like, okay, well, it's not life-threatening. It's just a paper cut. You know, so now you're going to start not feel that pain as much. So that's kind of what was going on with my elbow. I didn't feel essentially anything, right? Because I was so used to it. And so that was always in the back of my head. And then moving forward to 2018, the pain increased to where it was, like, noticeable. And then, you know, we get an image of it and the fracture got bigger, and you could see that because essentially the way they worded it was there's more fluid in the fracture, which means that the fracture is getting bigger, you know. So that was a telltale sign. All right, let's get it fixed. So that's kind of how it all started.
Gotcha. So this was something that you were just pretty much used to carrying with you everywhere you went. So you miss the rest of 2018 after you have the surgery. Pretty much all of 2018, you were out. You think you only pitched about a month in actual live games. And then you didn't start at the very beginning of 2019. I guess you were still recovering there. But then last year, 2019, you come back to the Flying Squirrels, and it seemed like basically you picked up right where you left off, if not looking even better, I guess, from being pain-free maybe having something to do with it, but how'd you feel getting back out there in live games after missing so much time away from playing baseball?
Yeah, so, you know, it was exciting. I don't think I would have missed any time in 2019, but this is crazy. I check another box off for me. But so I threw my first live batting practice post-surgery in the spring of 2019, early on. And I was dominant, back to me, right? I give everybody hugs, pretty emotional for everyone that was involved, because they see me from the day I had surgery walking in with a limp, you know, because they took bone from my hip and all this stuff. So these guys seen me at my worst. And like, those were the same guys that like pulled me aside when I was like essentially, you know, not well. And they're like, hey, this is just the beginning. We're going to keep going and we're going to get way better. He's like, you just need to mentally be there. And Trey, if you know me, you know that I'm always like mentally there. So for me, it was the easy rehab. But anyway, so through that live, I gave everybody hugs, and then I go run on my second sprint. I pull my hamstring. Second sprint, running just feels like somebody shot me in the back of the leg. So that delayed everything, and now we had to push everything back. And of course, like on a business standpoint, it's pretty easy. Even if I was ready to go for spring, it's pretty easy to say, hey, we're gonna hold this guy back, and we're going to give somebody else a chance, right? So that's kind of what it was. I was ready, but from a business side, the best thing to do was to hold me back, to let other guys go compete, right? Mm-hmm. Due to just having elbow surgery and the hamstring thing, which was fine. So I stayed in and extended for a while. And you know what? I was just like, you know what? That's fine. I'm going to just continue to do my job at the highest level. And I took that mentality with me every day, and it paid off. And a couple weeks later, I came to Richmond to see you. So,
yeah, it's and you went on to have a really good year with the Flying Squirrels in 2019. But I mean, all these kind of freak setbacks, right? You had the hand injury from football earlier on when you were in high school, and then the elbow, and then the hamstring, and then this year has kind of thrown you a few curveballs as well. You know, you get back to big league spring training this year, you're turning a bunch of heads, people are talking about you in big league camp, externally people are talking about you, and you did get reassigned to minor league camp, but you seem to be like making a splash and making an impression, and then COVID shut everything down, and then things start getting rolling again. You get invited to the 60-man player pool, you're competing for a spot and on the major league roster, and then Elliot Ramos smokes a line drive off your knee, and you have to take a little bit of a break there too. So a lot of bad luck there, but anytime I talk to you or hear from you or hear what you have to say, it seems like your head is always in a good space, right? Like you've always got the right mentality to just like, well, this is another speed bump. I'm going to go tackle this and make it happen.
Yeah, for sure. I think if you look at like the big picture, I got it made, you know, so I don't think for me there should be really anything to kind of complain about when it comes to the adversities that I've faced. Like there's a lot of people who would die and kill to be in my position, right? So for me to kind of take adversity and like pout about it would be pretty selfish. And, you know, just knowing that, like, especially right with everything going on now, with the pandemic, with the a mass equality movement, like for me, just getting hit in the knee was just like, whatever. Like this is nothing, right? Like this is a little bruise. Thankfully it was nothing major. So this is something I have to come back from, and it's just another speed bump. Like, look, it's not a broken elbow, it's a bruise. You know, let's heal up, and then let's go back to work. And I think that type of like mentality, I think it comes super easy for me, but I think a lot of people struggle with it. And you know, for those who do struggle with it, I just try to say like, take it step by step, right? So I'll use me getting hit in the knee for an example. Okay, we'll get hit in the knee. What's my next step? Let's assess the situation. Am I okay? Okay, well, you're fine. Nothing's broken. So what's the next step? Let's heal and let's focus on healing, right? And so just, you know, those who don't have that mental stability to continue to be positive, just take it step by step. And I think when it's all said and done, you can just laugh about it, you know, and kind of just reminisce on what you've been through. And that's kind of my thing. Like with the elbow injury, Trey, I was just super excited to get fixed. Like, so excited to get fixed, right? And I think like little mental positive notes like that go a long way in your everyday life. Like instead of saying, oh, I gotta work today, you should try to transition that to something as simple as have a great opportunity to work today. Like just little things like that go a long way. And I think that's kind of something that, you know, I've always tried to be consistent at.
Yeah, for sure. It's not necessarily like you live life in denial. It's that you focus on the positives. And I mean, a lot of us are going through it, right? Yeah. A lot of us are going through it right now in 2020. This year is so crazy. And like, you know, for me, there's no baseball and a huge part of my job is gone. And, you know, a lot of my friends are out of work and all this stuff is going on. People are having problems with the pandemic and people are sick all over the world. And there's, as you mentioned a moment ago, there's this massive movement for equality going on in the country and a lot of negative things that are causing that to happen. But anyway, at the same time, like trying to focus on selfishly trying to focus on some positive things like, well, I haven't had a summer in a decade, right? I get to be home in the evenings during the summer for the first time in like 10 years, like, you know, and have weekends during
the summer.
Exactly,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the selfish angle, at least, in trying to focus on the positive there and keep plugging forward until, you know, things are back to normal. I think that for everybody in America right now, there's people who are trying to keep that focus so that they can, you know, keep pushing through without getting too down. I mean, the experiences that you've gone through there from a baseball standpoint, there's a lesson that could be taken in that for kind of everybody we're all in this kind of a rut right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think if you could kind of put things into perspective like you just did, it makes it super, it makes it just easier to handle. Like, you know, if you try to complicate things and you overwhelm yourself, then it's going to be hard, right? But especially during these times, like, no, I have nothing really to complain about. I got food in the fridge, clothes on my back, and I got, you know, money in the bank. So it's like, I got a lot, you know, and in the bigger scheme of things compared to, like you just said, with everything that's going on. I mean, I know, you know, like you stated, friends and family who don't have jobs right now and who are legit, you know, struggling to find ways to pay their mortgage, to find ways to feed their kids, to find ways to feed themselves, you know. So just challenge everyone out there to slow down when it comes to jumping to conclusions and judging other people's situations, especially now.
Yeah, man, perspective is powerful sometimes.
Founded in 1996, SICOM is an award-winning IT systems integrator headquartered in Richmond with offices throughout Virginia. Their focus is on mid-Atlantic companies, healthcare organizations, educational institutions, and governments looking to improve their technology return on investment. SICOM is a trusted partner to deliver a range of IT solutions and services that keep companies connected. Named as one of the top workplaces in Richmond, SICOM is also the employer of choice for the best talent in the region and are committed to providing outstanding and memorable service.
Back to 2019 with Richmond, you got picked as an Eastern League All-Star last year in 2019. You know, you got to represent the Flying Squirrels in your own ballpark as we hosted the All-Star game last year. What was your All-Star week experience like?
Oh, it was fun, almost too fun. You know, the group of guys we had there were just unbelievable. We all took being an All-Star as a blessing. We just lived in the moment, and you know, you guys as a staff and you know, everyone that did their due diligence from, you know, Lou down to Parney, down to the, like, I can't really put into words the All-Star week because it's so hard to unless you were there. We should have done a documentary about it because that's how legendary it was. There was guys on our team that were big leaguers for years in the All-Star team, and they said that this All-Star break was the most fun that they've had since being in the show. So you could imagine, you know, how much fun was going on and camaraderie and just getting to know people within the league that were on other teams that you competed against. For some of us competed against each other for a couple of years, some for a few months. But the All-Star break was, you know, the All-Star week was amazing. And just the Squirrels family just didn't leave any stone unturned. It was just thorough and seamless. It was great.
Yeah, it was kind of it felt kind of big league there for a few days. I mean, we try to do big league effort in just about everything that we do, but that All-Star week was, you know, I came in so late in the process, they pretty much already had all that stuff planned out. They were already ready with it before I had nothing to do with any of the planning for any stuff that they did. But yeah, that was, I mean, I got to see it up close and it was awesome to watch. It seemed like everybody had a good time. I mean, I've been to other All-Star games. You were an All-Star in the Eastern League in 2017 and went through that experience. And like, the All-Star games are always fun, but man, it seemed like this one went to a different level, and there was so much going around it. And again, I'm not bragging. This isn't a self-pat at all. This is bragging on my teammates within that front office and the work that they did to put this thing together, because it seemed like they crushed it. I know I was busy and exhausted, but I had a blast. And, and from everybody who I've talked to who was a part of that from a player standpoint like you, it seemed like it was a pretty cool 4 days there, and a really fun experience.
Yeah, I mean, I'll brag because I don't got a horse in the race. I mean, every single person absolutely killed it. It was, I mean, through and through, just seamless. And, you know, they, when I say they, the Richmond Flying Squirrels staff, front office, and the community just did a great job. And I think that says a lot about the Squirrels as a whole, like how embedded they are in the community. Because if you would ask anyone in Richmond what they were doing for that All-Star week, they're going to the game. And if they weren't going to the game, they were upset and they're trying to find tickets on how to get to the game. And I think that this takes years of trials and tribulations to get to that point, to be so close to the community. And that's just a shout out to those who came before us and those who are there now.
Yeah, I mean, you've had a part in that. And, you know, you joked about spinning parts of 3 years there, which really, considering that, you know, you had the injury and the path that everything took, it's not like you were a double A lifer or somebody like even some guys who've made it and done well in the big leagues, like Mike Yastrzemski or Jared Hughes or something like that, who spent, each of them spent like 5 years in double A. But I mean, you're pretty active with some of the community projects that the Flying Squirrels do and giving back in that way. And that goes a long way. The people in the front office, of course, do a lot of work to do work in the community. But for you guys, where these places are just kind of a brief pit stop on your ride to the major leagues, like to take time to give back to the community and to help us make an impact in Richmond. I always think that that's awesome when we can get some of you guys to do some things like that, which you've taken part in over these last few years.
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up kind of like in an inner city melting pot here in the Bay Area. So I knew nothing but love when it came to person, place, thing, color, religious. That's all I know is love. So for me to kind of bring that same energy to a lot of these young folks that we're going to see and to show them that, like, hey, this is what genuine people are like. And I'm speaking for my teammates around me as well. Like, hey, this is what genuine people do, you know, and just to sacrifice a little bit of my time for predominantly we would go to people who weren't, you know, as fortunate as us, or, you know, for health reasons, financial reasons, you know, systematic reasons, which is a huge thing going on right now with equality. Oh, yeah. You know, just getting back to the roots of that and trying to show these young folks that, like, hey, there are some people that look like me that love everybody, and you could feel comfortable with me hanging out with you and joking with you and having fun and trying new things, right? So just kind of giving back to the community like that, it was huge. And I'm not really the biggest like social media guy when it comes to like bragging about, oh, I did this, you know, I kind of like to move kind of silently. I like to do it without anyone around. And I think that, you know, with the Richmond Flying Squirrel family, it was just, you guys did a great job at giving us that privacy for those who didn't want to be heard when they're doing, you know, these things in the community. And I'm just blessed to be a part of all those trips. I know that it's going to continue in Richmond, and the players after me are going to continue that tradition of giving back. And that's something that's been embedded in the Squirrels community forever, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And you, I mean, you've, like I said, you've been here for a big part of it. Over these last, well, I guess two of the last 3 years that you were in town for a good bit of time and getting to see it up close, I'm appreciative of what you do to help us make an impact in this community. I'm appreciative of the pitcher that you are and getting to go out and watch that. I knew when you were coming into the game that most likely we were going to have some quick innings and get out of there quick so I could go get some grub and get some rest. And it was a lot of fun getting to know you a little bit over the last year and a half or so after watching you from afar in the couple of years leading into that. Man, it's long overdue probably that we wrap this thing up. So Tyler Sear, thanks so much for taking some of your time today. And man, best of luck to you the rest of this summer. I know a lot of us here in Richmond are looking forward to watching you eventually at some point get the call to the major leagues and make that debut and have some success in the big leagues and get to pitch for your hometown team and all that whenever that time comes. But in the meantime, really enjoying get to follow along with your journey and watch how things are going, and looking forward to getting to actually watch you pitch on a mound and not in this weird extended spring training thing that we're in right now.
I appreciate it, Trey. Yeah. You know, the least I could do is give you some of my time. You've sat there and you've watched us through our highs and lows. So the least I can do is give you a couple hours of my time.
Hey, like I said, this was usually we go like 30, 45 minutes with these, and we've gone a lot longer than that today. So I appreciate all your time, and we'll catch up with you at some point again down the road. Thanks so much, man.
I appreciate it, Trey. Have a great day.
And that's a wrap for this episode of the Funville 9 driven by AAA. We'll be back with another episode soon. Make sure you tune in on Monday nights on Sports Radio 910 The Fan and 105.1 FM in the Richmond area or anywhere in the world through the radio.com app or through thefanrichmond.com to hear these episodes debut. That's each Monday night on Sports Radio 910 The Fan. We'll talk to you next time on the Funville 9 driven by AAA.
You've been listening to the Funville 9 driven by AAA, the official podcast of the Richmond Flying Squirrels.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.